TalkZone.com.
Now, the Wild About Pets radio show, the place to learn something new about household pets and wild animals. Here's your host, educator and naturalist, Susan Frank.
Hello, and welcome to Wild About Pets. This is the place we talk in depth to leading authors and experts about household pets or wild animals. Today, we'll be talking about how to watch wildlife. To make your listening experience more enjoyable and meaningful, I have a companion website, wildaboutpets.net, that allows you to see photographs of the animals we'll be talking about on the show today. To see these pictures while you're listening, just click the purple Look While You Listen button you see on the Talk Zone Wild About Pets show homepage. Who doesn't like looking at animals? Animal videos are some of the most popular on the internet. Animal TV shows such as Animal Planet have a huge following, and as always, zoos are favorite places to go with families. Is there another way, though, to see more unusual wildlife than the local birds or squirrels that live near you, than by sitting in front of a TV or computer, or by gazing at captive animals? There is. And now that it's October, it's the perfect time to get outside. My guest today, David Mizajewski, is a spokesperson and media personality with the National Wildlife Federation. And he will tell you about some of the great opportunities there are right now to see wildlife that you would not normally see. And all you have to do is be out there and know a little bit about who you're looking for and how to do it. You're going to find out today. Welcome, David. I'm thrilled to have you on the show.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
David Mizajewski is an expert on wildlife, our environment, and green lifestyles. He hosted and co-produced the series Backyard Habitat on Animal Planet and also writes a blog for Animal Planet called Animal Oddities. He's also a regular guest on The Today Show, The Martha Stewart Show, and Good Morning America. He's also the author of the book Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife, which we will be talking about a little bit later in the show. I have some photos of the animals that we will be talking about today, so if you'd like to see them while you are listening, click that purple Look While You Listen button that you see on the Talk Zone page. They will take you right to the photos on my website, wildaboutpets.net, so you can look while you listen. Also, the phone lines are open. We are streaming live. It's October 2nd. If you'd like to join our conversation and ask David a question about watching wildlife, just call 888-463-6748. Again, we're live. It's October 2nd, and the number to call is 888-GO-FOR-IT. David, why is the fall season a particularly good time to see animals?
Well, fall is the time when migratory species are on the move. Winter's coming, and, you know, migration is one strategy that certain wildlife species have adapted or evolved, you know, in order to survive the cold, lean times that are ahead. And just because of that, it's a great time to get outside and look around, and you might see things that you wouldn't otherwise see at different times of the year.
Now, of course, I'm here broadcasting from Chicagoland area, the Midwest, and so it is definitely fall here in the Midwest. But what about countrywide? I mean, we know it's still October everywhere, David, but is it equally good to see different animals moving, let's say, out in California where it still may be a lot warmer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it does vary from region to region and by species to species, and there is sort of a north to south gradient. Obviously, if you're further north, it's colder and the seasons are a little bit more advanced, so you're probably going to see more migratory wildlife earlier. But this time of year is actually kind of the peak in most parts of the country to see these wildlife species on the move. Early October is, migration usually starts, people don't realize this, in late summer. Usually around the middle of August, species are starting to begin their migration. And so, by this point, the migration is in full force and it's going to go through till the end of the month and maybe into early November for most species. There's a couple species that maybe, it will get pushed back further into the fall. But yeah, pretty much anywhere you are in the country at this time of year, it's a great time to get out and see wildlife.
I suppose, depending upon where you are, you're either watching maybe the animals start to either emerge from where they were, like we're going to be talking about bats in a while, and so either they're leaving where they had been spending the summer, and so either people can see them as they start departing, other people in the country would see them as they're passing overhead, and I would suppose then there will be the people who will see them arrive at the destination that they're headed for.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most fun parts in my mind is that depending on where you live in the country, you actually might be south for, you know, when you say birds fly south for the winter, you might actually be south. And that doesn't mean, you know, Florida or southern Texas always. You know, in some cases, the mid-Atlantic or the Midwest or, you know, central California is south for some of these migratory species. So that's kind of neat too. The species that you have around you all summer long might be going down to the tropics, and the species that live up in Canada during the warm breeding season in the spring and summer come down oftentimes to the, you know, middle or southern U.S.
Sure. Well, actually, let's get into a little bit about where they're going to be moving. And we're going to be talking today about some birds, mammals, and of course, the most famous of insects that migrate, the monarch butterfly. But as you were mentioning, some of these different areas on my website, if you look at photo number 2, we have a map divided into 4 regions showing the birds that migrate and their flyways. And there are 4 of those. And what I'd like us to do is, as we go, through our conversation today, is talk a little bit about some of the different birds. Let's start with them, because I think they're the most obvious and easily seen just by looking up animals. And so we can look through some of the photographs as we go along and see the different flyways.
That's right.
And, yes, David.
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to say about the flyways, what's interesting about them is that, you know, there's a lot of overlap in species because, you know, not the species that are out there don't only live in the one section of, say, the Atlantic Flyway. And so, you know, you might be seeing similar species in the Atlantic Flyway as you might see in the Mississippi Flyway. But there, it's a really interesting way of kind of thinking about wildlife. And it really makes, I think it's a really good example of how, you know, wildlife doesn't necessarily see our political borders. You know, they don't see state lines. And quite honestly, they don't see country lines either. And by looking at the flyways, you really get a sense of how we kind of really need to work together in order to make sure that these wildlife species have the ability to get from point A to point B, traveling literally across our entire country and often jumping the borders between Canada and Mexico. And without, you know, kind of all of us working together, the species are going to have a really difficult time.
Okay, so let's be specific. What do you mean by all of us working together to help this happen?
Well, I mean, it's everything from the big picture, you know, say on the, you know, conservation laws and international conservation, and even down to the, you know, sort of the major metropolitan area level. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of our major cities happen to sit smack in the middle of these migratory flyways. And that's for a reason, because they're great habitats for people as well as wildlife. And, you know, unfortunately, cities and densely populated areas tend to have the most habitat destruction. So, you know, our cities can get together. And in fact, this is a project that National Wildlife Federation is working on, a flyway cities coalition, looking at different cities and trying to help connect the dots with all the different conservation groups and green initiatives so that there can be kind of a comprehensive green space initiative that will help both local and migratory species. So, you know, it can be on that level, but it can really also be on your own individual level. And I know we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but, you know, by doing things that are green, so to speak, or good for the environment in your own yard or garden, that can actually ensure that migratory species have the resources they need as they're passing through, and they need a lot of resources. You know, I mean, it's a long trip from Canada to Costa Rica, you know, so, you know, migratory species need stopover spots, and your yard or garden can serve that role and actually help the species survive its migratory path. And if you do it and your neighbor does it and, you know, your cousin in the next state over and so on and so forth, you can really see how those tiny individual efforts can add up to a bigger conservation success.
Well, I love that idea. And yes, as we get into our third segment where we're going to be talking about your book and how to attract wildlife to our backyards, that will be a lovely connection for our whole conversation. Well, since, of course, we are really talking about how people can, you know, be out there and see so much more, why, David, shouldn't people just, you know, go to the zoo? I mean, obviously, you know, people want to get out and do things and not be in front of the computers or TVs. But, you know, we're used to seeing animals captive in the zoo. What is really the benefit of, you know, being out there to see these animals that you can, you know, name for us?
Well, you know, there's not actually, you know, most zoos anyway are great places, and they're doing a lot of really important conservation work. Some of them are involved with endangered species breeding. Most zoos are play a really critical role in getting people aware about wildlife and conservation issues and things like that. And, you know, oftentimes for me, the, you know, actually just watching the animals that are in the enclosures is the least important and least fun thing to do at a zoo. And that a zoo could be a great place where you do go outside, kind of get yourself unplugged and get into the outdoors. But in general, there's a whole bunch of reasons why getting outside is important. And this is actually a really big issue for us at the National Wildlife Federation. We're launching a new campaign called Be Out There this month. And the name kind of says it all. It's all about reconnecting with nature by getting into the outdoors. Some scary statistics are out there. The average American kid is spending over 6 hours a day indoors in front of electronic screens. So they're watching TV, they're playing computer games, they're text messaging, they're listening to their iPod. And, you know, nothing's wrong with any of those activities, except when you do them over 6 hours a day. Don't get outside at all anymore. And we're, you know, we're really raising a generation of what we're calling indoor kids, you know, and indoor kids just are not as healthy, they're not as creative, and they have much less knowledge of the natural world. And so by encouraging kids and encouraging really parents and educators to get kids back into the outdoors, we're hoping not only to combat things like childhood obesity and childhood diabetes, both of which are skyrocketing with the advent of this indoor kid phenomenon, but also to get by getting the kids outside, they'll learn a little bit more about the natural world. Because the reality is, you know, the old saying is totally true, that you only protect what you love and you only love what you know, and you only know what you've been taught. And, you know, kids today are not having, we're robbing them of the opportunity to know the natural world. And so Wildlife Watch is one of our many programs at National Wildlife Federation that we put out there to help people be out there.
And I very much enjoy the pages on the website, the Be Out There section and the Wildlife Watch. And I have links at the bottom of the page of photos to both of those sites. They're great. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about those as we go through. But yes, they're wonderful and fun and interactive. So I would hope that if people and some of these indoor kids, you know, learn about those websites, go to them, that those will encourage and motivate them to take what they learn on those websites and then get outside.
Exactly. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head, is that, you know, like I just said, there's nothing wrong with the internet. There's nothing wrong with television. You know, you mentioned my Animal Planet series that I did. You know, I'm on television, you know. So
right.
The point is, though, is not that these are inherently evil or bad. It's just keeping things in balance. And for us, the National Wildlife Federation, we try to use them as a catalyst to get people outside. And, you know, to just take the Wildlife Watch website as an example. When you go there, we've got it broken out by state. And so you can look at your state, and myself and other colleagues here have selected a group of species that you can observe in your state. And we change the species out every season. So, you know, it kind of stays current. And you can look at pictures of these species. You can get identification tips. You can read a little bit about them. You can print off a checklist of all the species that you can see in your state that you can take outside with you. And when you are done, you know, with all going out and experiencing nature and looking for all these cool animals, and you're back inside, you can go back to the website and you can post what you've seen to our website. It'll put a little pinpoint on a map. You can write a comment in there. You can share your story. You can share your photos. We've got a great Flickr webpage, all integrated right into our Wildlife Watch website. You can use Twitter if you're into Twitter and tweeting, you can post.
Who's not?
Yeah, you can post your wildlife observations right through Twitter, and it will appear for everybody else to see right on our Wildlife Watch website. So it's really cool. We try to use technology in ways that help people, you know, again, get outside and connect with nature a little bit more than they otherwise would.
Yes, and it's so much fun. I love that interactive aspect. And I loved that, as you said, you can post what you saw and people are already doing that. And that's a wonderful activity. And of course, I want to again restate basically what you said, that there's many activities that you are suggesting. Because I know sometimes the idea of, oh, you know, come on, family, we're going to go for a walk and look what we can see, that doesn't quite have the same thrill or excitement, but it can be, because there's so many different activities and things that, you know, that you mentioned that can be done. And as we go through, I'll share some things also that I, when of course I was working as a naturalist, loved to do. Something you also mentioned about healthier, David, I definitely believe in the philosophy that feels that those people who spend time outdoors are healthier and happier for it. And I'm not just talking about the normal, you know, health, physical health benefits of exercise. I'm really talking about that emotional state of happiness and health. And I know in this day and age when people, I think, are more stressed and more worried, that for me, there is nothing better than leaving my office, leaving the worries behind, and I just find a place almost just to sit. I'm not talking about taking major hikes. Just sit, and there's a calm unlike any other that comes over me, and that is the way that I really cope with some of the difficulties and challenges that we're all facing. Do you find that also true for you?
Absolutely, and it's not just you, and it's not just me. There's research out there that shows all of that to be true. And with kids in particular, kids that get outside not only are more physically fit, you know, they have less issues with obesity and things like that, they have better immune systems, they're more creative, they do better on school tests, you know, they do better academically. And, you know, there's a connection there. I mean, when you're inside and you're not active and you're not you're sort of engaging your mind and your creativity. And another piece of this, by the way, is the fact that kids in particular are so overscheduled. That even if they are getting physical exercise through group sports and things like that, which are awesome, they oftentimes don't ever have the ability to think creatively. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, and generations my age and younger, you know, a lot of times we were, you know, told go outside and play, and,
right,
and you had to make up your games.
Right.
And unfortunately, kids today oftentimes are so, again, overscheduled, they never are given an opportunity because everything is always laid out for them. Well, you know, from 2 to 3, you're going to be here. From, you know, 4 to 5, you're going to be here. Then it's dinner time, you know. And so they never get a chance for this unstructured outdoor playtime that is so crucial to developing that, again, that sense of creativity, that sense of decision making. These are all really important things, and getting outside really is the antidote to so many of these problems. And that's why National Wildlife Federation has all of these great programs and why we have our Be Out There campaign, because we really want to help kids and families and parents feel empowered to do this. You know, a lot of parents are afraid of going outside themselves, and so we try to provide parents with a lot of information and resources and fun games and activities. Well, another program we have is called Green Hour, and, you know, it's all about, you know, kind of get, you know, eat an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Well, mm-hmm. Green Hour a day. And it's really targeted at parents and moms in particular, and saying, hey, you know, you guys can do this. It's not that difficult. You don't have to be a naturalist. You don't have to be a nature expert. You know, you can have these fun, meaningful activities with your kids or for your kids. You don't even have to always be involved. And, you know, you mentioned a minute ago going, you know, outside and kind of going on a walk and just saying, oh, let's look around. And that might not be terribly exciting, but it's an example of something that anybody can do anywhere. You know, I mean, maybe it's after dinner, you turn off the TV and you go for a walk with the family.
And
it doesn't have to be anything really intense or something that is a formal activity. And maybe it's just looking around saying, hey, kids, how many different kinds of trees can you spot on our walk, on our half an hour walk or whatever? Take the dogs out. You know, it's great exercise for you. It's great family time. It's physical exercise, and it's connecting them with nature.
And when we come back after this short break, we'll look at how you can have a good idea of what you're going to be looking for and what you can spot that will make that walk so much fun for your whole family. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.